James said that religion is a function of that part of our minds through which intuitions come, that part of our minds through which the artist or the poet gets his inspiration, and the prophet also gets his inspiration. The prophet feels that God is speaking through him. He feels that something is coming into his conscious life from beyond his conscious life. It's something deeper. And so you often hear it, sir, it used to be said often in a friend's meeting, center down. Center down to the depths. Don't live on the surface. Ideas are on the surface. Get below the surface, into the depths of your soul. And there you'll find God speaking to you, if he chooses to. James was afraid to use the word God in varieties of religious experience. Oh, he did use it, but in a very untheological way. When he spoke of God as working through the unconscious into the conscious, and anything that comes from the unconscious has a much more powerful influence on us than our conscious ideas. The conscious is not in control of the unconscious, but the unconscious is in control of the conscious. So if an advertiser, for instance, wants to get an idea into the unconscious, and that's what they try to do, so that it bubbles up from the depths into your conscious life when you're not expecting it, some jingle perhaps, any kind of a jingle, doesn't matter. What is it? Winston tastes good as a cigarette should. If I say that often enough, it'll get into your subconscious and it will influence you in a way that you don't expect or prepare for. And that, of course, is the secret of the advertisers who run the presidential campaigns. Presidential campaigns today are not in control of politicians. They're in control of Madison Avenue, the advertising experts who know how to get an idea into the unconscious where it's out of control, it can't be critically observed, and it emerges into the conscious life to control it. And so we have Nixon spending more than $20 million mostly on advertising experts who told him just what to do in order to get control of the unconscious life of the American people. Humphrey only had $6 million, so he didn't make it. So it was a battle of the advertising experts. Eisenhower was elected because the advertising experts succeeded in creating him into a kind of father figure, a paternalistic figure. Now, every human being has a father image in his mind, which he inherits from his youth, when he was more dependent on his father. And so if the American people could be taught to look up to Eisenhower as a father image, then he had it. He won. Stevenson, his opponent, was just an intellectual, and his ideas were on the surface. But the advertisers were not dealing with the surface, they were dealing with the depths. And it's always the depths that win. Some years ago, Gerald Hurd was in residence at Pendle Hill. I think Murray Friedman mentioned Gerald Hurd and Aldous Huxley last night, at least I heard he did. When they first came to from England to New York, they didn't like New York, so they headed straight for Pendle Hill and stayed here. And after several weeks, they left, but Gerald Hurd came back to lecture and be part of our community, a very important part. While he was here, he wrote a Pendle Hill pamphlet. I think it's about number 6 or 7 or something like that. You'll find it in the library. And he called it a Quaker mutation. And he considered Pendle Hill a Quaker mutation. Now, a mutation is a process in evolution where evolution takes a jump. It doesn't go gradually from one stage to another, but a sudden jump from one stage to another. And biologists now accept mutations as one explanation of evolution. So many things have occurred in evolution that couldn't possibly have occurred by a whole infinite series of happy accidents. The cell has a capacity for doing the unexpected, and it's these unexpected and radical changes that have produced human beings and other forms of life. Well, Gerald Hurd, in this pamphlet at Quaker Mutations, thought that Pendle Hill was a new mutation in education, departing radically from the type of education which concerned entirely the intellect. That is, most colleges and universities treat their students to analyze. They treat the analytical mind, not the integral mind. And so he felt that at Pendle Hill, where we have all three types of education, the body, the mind, and the spirit, the body in our mutual work, our community work, which is part of our education, as well as a good help to Pendle Hill, but it is part of our education, tended to be, and our meeting for worship, and our lectures. In the old universities of the Middle Ages, they had three departments. As I tried to say in my pamphlet on education, they had the liberal arts, the divine arts, the liberal arts, and the useful arts. The divine arts centered in the chapel, and there you learned theology and religion. In the liberal arts centered in the library, and there you learned about Plato and Aristotle and the great intellectuals. And the useful arts centered in the kitchen and the farm, where the monks did actually do farming. The Benedictine monks were the ones who taught farming to the men of the Middle Ages. They were the great pioneers in education, and you'll see often on a Benedictine garb a small golden or silver axe, which is the only kind of an axe they use anymore, but they used to use a real one in the early days to cut down forests and create farms. So if you have all three arts, the divine arts, the liberal arts, and the useful arts, then you have an integrated education. That is, you're trying to educate the whole person and not just the top of the head, which is all the college or university tries to do. Not the whole psyche, but the tool-using part, the part that is concerned with means and not end. Now, this type of education, this education of the subconscious, can be used for good or evil, just like anything else. I think Hitler, in his use of slogans, he got these slogans to penetrate the mind of the German people, and although they were the most highly educated people in the world, yet they fell victims to his slogans, complete victims. And he carried them along with him through his slogans. So if you can get a slogan working, even if it's for evil or for good, you have gone a long way in your education of the unconscious. But Hurd felt, whether rightly or wrongly, not entirely rightly, I think, that Pendle Hill was a mutation and had invented an entirely new type of education, which existed in the Middle Ages, along about 800 to 1000 AD, in the universities of that time, which were in the monasteries and which were conducted by the monks of the monasteries, who worked on the farms, who cooked the meals, and who worked in the library and the chapel. So if you want to know what Gerald Hurd thinks Pendle Hill is or ought to be, read A Quaker Mutation. We had during that summer when he was here, about four of us met together to plan a new kind of community. And one of our members, a very brilliant person, Teresina Rao, who taught for 5 years at Pendle Hill, he's the greatest expert I know in Oriental religions, wrote down our proceedings, which I still have, and she did it in a kind of a caricature, you might say. not altogether serious in what she reported. I still have those records. We called our order the New Friends, different in several respects from the present Society of Friends. Well, that's another story. I better get back to James. Now, James had, I don't think I could make a diagram of James. I don't think he would like it very much. But if you think of, some of this chalk is hard and some is soft. If you have here the ego, this is this soft or hard? I guess it's soft enough. Here's the ego. That's be yourself, what you are now, your self-conscious self. And out around it, I can't make a boundary, there's no boundary to it. It's like space, like outer space. You never come to the end of it. Would be the unconscious. Here would be the unconscious. Now, James felt that there was something way out here. He didn't call it God because he didn't want to be unscientific. Though James was a devoutly religious man, but he called it the more, M-O-R-E with a capital M. And there is a more, he says, through which saving experiences come. And it's real because it produces real effects. Anything for James was real, which produced real effects. Now this more would actually change people's lives. And at a revival meeting, you might have your life suddenly changed, like Paul on the way to Damascus. He suddenly changed from a persecutor of the Christians to one of the most devout supporters of the Christian religion, all in a very short space of time. Now, outside of this ego, there was another one gradually forming. Outside of this self, another ego was forming. It was produced by your education, listening to your teachers, your preachers, your parents, your so on. They were all building up another self, which was different from this self. This self might appear to you to be an evil self. Then there might be, between this self and this self, there might be a tension. And he called that the divided self. He has a whole chapter on the divided self. And in every one of my 300 Quaker journals, you can find three or four pages where the journalist felt that his self was divided. He felt there were two forces pulling at him, one in one direction and one in the other. Now, there's two ways. If this self replaces this self, this is a good self and this is a bad self. Now, if the good self replaces the bad self gradually, James would call that a once-born man. If this self replaces this self suddenly and quickly, then you're twice born. You have a new self gotten at a certain time and place. You can even name the day and hour when the new self replaced the old self. Now that does happen, and it has happened a good many times in the history of religion when a person has changed suddenly from one kind of a person to another. We're all divided somewhat, like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, there have been cases recorded in psychology where two quite different personalities lived in the same body. They had different characters, different voices, different ways of looking at life, and one was in possession of the body, and then the other. And they might be jealous of each other, and one might know about the other, but the other wouldn't know about that one. And the relation between the two would be studied by psychologists. Sometimes there would be three, and when it started to break up into more than two, then it would get three and four, and at the end would be insanity. A divided self or a double self is not unusual. I think we all have more than one self. Sometimes you might get up in the morning feeling like a very bad self, and then after a cup of coffee you might have a different self, quite different. We do change.